that they pressed their mouth against yours, and then the room spun away. David broke the embrace first, taking a step back and smiling.
There will be plenty of time for that,
he said.
I wish I could skip. See you in an hour.
When he was gone, Stevie unzipped her suitcase and looked down at what she smilingly had called her packing. Unlike Janelle, who had planned outfits for every day and layered them in day-to-day order in compressed packing cubes, Stevie packed like someone who just heard that reports of the monster were true and it was headed toward the city. And what was weird was that she had really tried. She had pulled things out of her drawers and closet at Ellingham and put them on the bed and tried to make sartorial sense of it all. She was the kind of person who had both kinds of shirts, the t-shirts with writing on them and those without. There were the jeans she liked, the ones that fit okay, and the ones that fit badly, but she'd bought them and was therefore stuck with them for the rest of her life, or whatever it was that happened to jeans. She'd brought the one dress she owned, which was black and still had the tags on it. All these things had been shoved into the bag in a teeth-grinding frenzy the day before she left, because she was up late the night before, writing a paper that was already 2 days late. She had, she discovered, only brought 3 pairs of socks. One thing, however, was securely packaged and packed. She removed this and took it down the hall, where Janelle was delicately removing her journaling supplies from her carry-on bag and lining up her pens and notebooks on the desk. I need to show you something, Stevie said, coming in and shutting the door behind her. Do you want to see what I bought? For the thing. Janelle's eyes opened a bit wider. Let me see. Stevie ripped into the packaging. I got it yesterday right before we left, she said. I had to shove it in my bag before I could even open it. She ripped through the inner plastic bag, knocking loose 2 silica gel packs. She shook out the garment and held it up for inspection. Janelle stared for a long moment.
Is that a union suit? She said.
It's a fleece-lined onesie.
I can't believe it. You found a sex hoodie.
Hear me out, Stevie said. It doesn't seem like it's for sexy times, but it's got all these buttons. She indicated the buttons as proof. And you can undo the buttons, and...
Stevie looked at the onesie that hung from her hands. All the details stood out to her. The brightness of the black and red check, the body-obscuring thickness of the fleece, the sturdy closures. It had made so much sense when she'd picked it out.
I think whatever works for you is the right thing, Janelle finally said. And that is the most you thing I have ever seen.
June 24th, 1995. 8 p.m. In the afternoon, the rain started up again. Not like last night this time. It didn't pound the roof and windows. It pattered. It misted the glass. It rinsed the flowers and turned the earth soft, releasing the smell of ozone. The house fell into soft shade, and the 9 sat inside it, quiet and broken, as the day slipped away. Outside, there were 3 police cars and a van, officers in uniform walking across the muddy lawn. Suze watched them from the sitting room window. An hour before, she had been sobbing so hard that she had been physically ill. They had been asked to remain in the house, and specifically in the sitting room, while the police examined the rest of the house. One by one, they had been taken out to give statements. Sebastian had been asked to come out for a second round, as it was his house and the police had some additional questions. They were waiting for him to return. Angela sat between Peter and Yash. Theo curled in on herself in a reading chair and stared at the cold embers in the fireplace. Julian paced around the room, looking at the shelves, the walls, the backs of the furniture. It was cold inside Merryweather, but no one had the initiative to start a fire. Nor would it have been clear if they would be allowed to do so. Could you burn logs after a murder?
What the hell is happening? Suze said, mostly to herself. Are we having a nightmare? All of us?
There was a creaking sound. Sebastian was returning down the stairs from his questioning. They all turned to look at him as he entered the room. The normally bouncy and smiling Sebastian was now hunched. The color had not returned to his face, and he kept rubbing his skin as if there still might be blood somewhere on it. He had washed his face at least 6 times, rubbing the skin until it was raw. He walked straight to the bar cart and reached for the nearest bottle.
"They said we are allowed to go to our rooms if we want,"
he said.
"They're finished up there. We still can't go outside. We'll have to stay here at least for tonight. After that..."
He let the sentence trail off. After that, who knew? The future had changed.
"They also said there have been a string of burglaries recently,"
he went on.
4 times in this area in the last few weeks. They've been nicking tack and things."
"Burglars,"
Yash said after a moment.
"Fucking burglars?"
It was so horrifically absurd. It sucked the meaning out of the world. Suze began to tap her foot on the floor, then got to her feet and circled the sofa.
"I don't understand," she said. "Wasn't that shed locked? You said everything was locked. How did Rosie and Noel get in there if it was locked?"
"I don't know."
Sebastian swirled his drink to steady himself.
"I suppose Rosie and Noel went in after the door was ripped open. They must have heard them or seen them, tried to stop them. Or they went in there and the burglars came back and found them."
Angela stood up suddenly.
"You all right, Ange?"
Peter asked.
"I need to change my clothes," Angela said. "I need to take these off. I need a bath."
She rubbed her arms violently and hurried from the room back up the steps. Angela felt like a ghost moving out of time. Yesterday, they had rushed down this hallway, screaming with laughter as they grabbed their favorite rooms. Now the doors were all cocked open from when the police had trampled through. There had been strangers in the house, strangers in the suitcases, strangers in the drawers and closets. The view outside was just as lovely and lush as ever. Just outside the window, there were wild dog roses with their delicate pink petals and sunny bellies. Their beauty offended her, confused her. She wasn't sure if she was real.
Real was Noel. Long and lean Noel, with his slow smile and moony face and his nerdy, cool 70s style. Noel, who said the most surprising things sometimes. The freckles under his eyes you could only see in the bright sun.
She remembered a night that she and Noel stole a shopping trolley and pushed each other down the street and looked up at the sky and talked about how much they loved Bagpuss. Noel, who asked so little of everyone else, who always did the washing up, who could not drink tequila or he would turn into a strange creature who liked to run naked down the road. Noel, the nice guy who played villains shockingly well, who let anyone use his car. Real was Rosie's green eyes that always held laughter. The jeans she had been wearing that had nail varnish on the knee, the rope bracelets on her wrist. Rosie sitting with her before Christmas. The two of them wrapping gifts, Rosie telling Angela how she thought the Blur album, Modern Life is Rubbish, was her album, because it had a song on it called Villa Rosie, and one called Pressure on Julian.
"It's fate, Ange, me and Jules. Damon Albarn is sending us messages."
Rosie coming to her room the night before with a secret.
"I saw something. Something I didn't understand."
Dramatic Rosie.
"But I think I might understand it now."
"No. Frightened Rosie. Dead Rosie. And now Angela had seen something too, something she didn't understand. If she didn't get into the tub of hot water, she would die. The water would make the world make sense, stop the ringing in her ears. She turned on the taps, ripped off her shirt and jeans and let them fall to the bathroom floor, and sat on the rim of the tub. She tested the water with her hand, found it was far too hot, and got in anyway, letting her skin prickle against the burn. It made her itch all over, and she rubbed her legs and let her face flush. The pain of the heat distracted her. The water was loud, let it wash everything away, scald it off her.
When the water was higher than it should have been, she leaned forward and closed the taps, then sat hunched over her knees, watching the rain.
I saw something. Something I didn't understand.
Her mouth was so dry. Her head hurt. They'd had so much to drink the night before. There was a rapping on the bathroom door.
It's me, Theo said. Can I come in?
The nine lived and worked on top of one another. Between changing backstage, the house, and the romances, they had seen each other in every stage of undress. There was nothing strange about having visitors when you were in the bath. Theo slipped in and set the mug down on a chair next to the tub.
I brought you this, she said. I know you don't like sugar in your tea, but you need it right now. How are you so calm?
Angela asked.
I'm not calm, Theo said plainly. I'm in shock, like we all are. It will wear off in time for each of us in a different way. The shock is why you're so cold. I'm cold as well. We need to stay warm, to eat. Stay hydrated.
Theo went to leave, but Angela stopped her.
Wait a minute,
Angela said.
I need to talk to you. Shut the door.
Theo closed the door.
Something's not right, Theo. When we got here yesterday,
Angela lowered her voice, which echoed around the bathroom and the water and the tiles.
Rosie pulled me aside and said she had something to tell me.
About Julian?
Not Julian, something else. It was something, I don't know, something serious. And I know Rosie is,
she was not prepared to say Rosie was,
kind of dramatic sometimes, but this was different. She said she saw something. She said it was something she didn't understand. She needed to tell me about it, but she didn't have a chance. She was going to tell me after we played the game.
Saw something?
That's what she said. It was so odd and intense. And she didn't give you any idea what? There's something else.
Angela hugged her knees tighter into her chest and rubbed some sweat that was running into her eyes.
I saw something last night. I've been thinking about it all morning, but I didn't want to say it in front of everyone, because I don't know what it means either. Last night, when we were seeking, I went past the woodshed. The lock was off the door. Not unlocked. Missing.
Angela, Theo said slowly. I saw that lock on the door this morning. The woodshed was locked. That's why they ripped off the latch.
It was off in the middle of the night, Angela replied. I passed the woodshed last night. I saw the lock was off and tried to get in, but the door was stuck on the inside. I saw a light under the door. I called, but no one replied. I rattled the door a bit, and then I gave up. But I'm telling you, the lock was off the door.
Theo sat on the floor next to the tub.
Ange, she said. Our heads are going to play games with us. We need to keep clear heads and get each other through this. I don't know how we move on from here, or how we live like this without them. But I know we must take care of each other. I love you all so much, and I...
She could not finish. Angela retreated into herself. She could see it so clearly. She had gone up to the door. The lock was gone, and the light was squirreling around inside. The flashes had attracted her over to the door.
That's right. She'd seen something, and she could tell there was someone on the other side of that door, waiting, listening.
She'd felt it.
Hadn't she?
6. Even though David kept referring to the place they were going as the local, it was a few streets away, past two other pubs. And as he pointed out, though it was only 4:30 when they headed out the door, it was already night, for all intents and purposes. The sky was dark and tinged with purple, and orange-tinted streetlights were on.
It gets dark stupid early here in the fall, David said, especially when it's overcast, which is a lot of the time.
London's street layout was like the web of a drunk spider. Some streets curved and ended abruptly. Some were honeycombed with passages and mews. Alleys wove the baffling structure together. Words on the street reminded idiot Americans like herself which way the traffic was coming from, and every time they went to cross one, she turned the wrong way.
You have to choose your pub wisely,
David went on.
This one has the best drink specials, the best music, and they look the other way when we bring in food from other places. The others, like these weird-ass nachos from the place on the corner.
He indicated a place called Señor Sam's.
But English nachos are very bad. Do not eat English nachos. I swear to God, I've seen them put baked beans on them. Fish and chips, however, are very good. That's not a stereotype. That's fact. And that's what we are getting.
They entered an inauspicious place called Mr. Chips, a pocket-sized place, painted stark white with just three small tables that no one sat at. There was a menu on the wall that was perplexing. Stevie understood the component words, but they were in combinations that seemed to have a magical significance that she wasn't getting.
I can order for us, David said. I'll get a mix of stuff. My treat. Two regular cod and chips, two regular haddock and chips, a scampi and chips. A battered burger?
Nate said, a certain amount of awe in his voice.
Go for it, David said. Arteries are for losers.
Several items were dumped into deep fat fryers. A rich, unhealthy smell filled the air, and they soon were back out into the evening holding a stack of styrofoam boxes. The pub was called the Seven Bishops, and it looked more like what Stevie was expecting. Something cheerfully Dickensian, painted shiny black with gold lettering and a sign with a picture of a mitre on it. The dark facade was broken by a chessboard of windows, and a cheering warm light glowed from within. Inside, there was a wooden bar studded with tap handles. There were wooden booths with high walls, making cozy chambers for people to gather in. A few of these were still empty.
We got here just in time,
David said, staking one of these with the pile of food.
Drinks. What does everyone want?
Like, drinks? Vi replied.
Whatever you want.
Janelle had turned 18 in October, and Nate followed in early November. Stevie, however, would not turn until December, and Vi until February. They had all discussed what they were going to do once they got here. They had planned on this. But being in the pub still felt, well, foreign.
Stop worrying, David said. See this?
He pointed to the pile of food in front of them.
This is a meal. You're allowed to have drinks with a meal when you're 16.
Seriously? Janelle said. What a weird law.
Welcome to the home of the weird law. Here's another one I learned in my Introduction to UK and International Law lecture. The Salmon Act, 1986. It's illegal to handle salmon in a suspicious manner. I'll be watching. Now, drinks, come on, what do you want?
What's good, Vi said. I want something that's right for here. A pint of something? You pick it out. David nodded and looked to Janelle, who was eyeing the bar curiously.
I don't like beer, Janelle said. Is there something else?
There's cider, David offered. It's a little sweeter.
Janelle accepted this. Nate stuck with Coke. David turned to Stevie.
I don't know, she said. I guess...
She felt stupid saying pint. She wanted to do the things, all the things. She just didn't know how.
I guess...
Someone walked by with a wine glass. She'd had wine before, champagne actually, warm in a mug sitting on the bathroom floor with Element Walker on her first day at Ellingham. That felt right. A toast to Ellie.
Do you want one of those?
He asked, following her gaze.
A white wine?
Sure.
They settled into the padded green booth and looked out the many panes of the leaded window.
Well,
Nate said, flipping open one of the containers and taking out a fry.
We made it, and nothing weird has happened yet.
Why would you even say that?
Janelle replied, examining the large pieces of fried fish and delicately removing one.
I'm saying shit follows us around. I give it 3 days.
The fries were thick and hot as the tears of the sun, and the fish was every bit as good as David had promised. Overhead, Harry Styles sang out over the noise of the crowd, suggesting treating people with kindness. David returned with the drinks and slid in beside Stevie and slipped his arm over her shoulders, naturally. Stevie sipped at the white wine, It had a friendly taste and filled her head with a happy warmth. They were all together again. All her friends. David. David so close that she could push her face into the curve of his neck. She had to restrain herself. She wanted to do much more.
"We've got to eat kind of quickly. We've got to leave in,"
he consulted his phone.
15 minutes.
David was not the kind of person they typically wanted to follow to a second location, but here, he was the guide. It made Janelle visibly nervous. Vi was clearly fine with it, and Nate just wanted something to eat and was prepared to go against his better judgment. They polished off the fish and chips, drained the glasses, and pushed out of the booth back into the night. He took them out a back passage, through a short tunnel and over a bridge, finally emerging on the riverbank on the far side. There was no visible rain, but microscopic needles of moisture blew through the air directly into their faces. David put his arm around Stevie, drawing her to his side. It was awkward walking this way, but nothing in the world had ever been better. The wine was on her lips, and there was a happy fuzziness in her head that smeared the lights of London into a painter's palette of shine and color. The dark waters of the Thames plugged along beside them, smelling faintly of the sea. Or was that something else? Her senses were jumbled. She was tired and heavy and extremely awake all at once. David had a jaunty, springy walk. He hadn't shaved in maybe a day or two, and there was a bit of shadow over his chin and above his lip. He must have known how good this looked, or else he would have gotten rid of it. It was the perfect amount of stubble, an artistic amount of stubble. The sweater was new, black, form-fitting. Was all of this for her? Was the world really this good? The wine warmed her brain, and her hormones warmed the rest. She needed this night to go on and never stop. They walked briskly back along the river, past the tourist information and the London Dungeon and a merrily painted old-fashioned carousel. Ahead of them was a massive illuminated wheel. It dominated the riverfront like a spinning crown, glowing a purple-blue. This was the London Eye, a Ferris wheel of epic proportions. It didn't have seats. It had pods, sealed glass rooms that could hold maybe 20 people as they made their way up and around. Only a few people were in line. It seemed that not many people wanted to come out on a wet November night like this. There was a girl standing off by herself. She was tall and angular, with a sweeping point of a chin. Even through her thick duck-egg blue coat, you could tell her elbows were pointy. She had a mass of brown hair whipped up into a messy bun, and an oversized pair of glasses guarding a pair of brown eyes with carefully winged liner. She was waving her arms in their direction, like she was guiding in a plane.
"Who is that?" Stevie asked.
"That," he said as they approached her, "is Izzy. She's one of my tutorial partners. And Iz, this is everyone."
"You're Stevie," she said, "and Janelle? And Vi, and Nate. Did I get it right?"
She had, in fact, identified them all correctly.
"David talks about you all the time," she said, "constantly. I've been so excited to meet you."
Normally, if someone said this to Stevie, she would have thought they were being sarcastic, or at least overdoing things a bit. Izzy seemed to mean it. She had a bright, enthusiastic fizz about her, along with a vague air of apology. She was one of those people who, like Janelle, knew how to accessorize. She wore multiple stacked rings on her fingers, at least 6. Earrings that looked like little baskets of flowers. A purple and yellow silk scarf knotted around her neck. Janelle was clocking all of this with an approving look.
"We're all set," she said to David. "We've got the last one."
She turned to the group and indicated they should step toward the boarding platform.
"A friend of the family works for the company that runs this," Izzy explained. "The one perk I have is that I can get rides on the Eye for free whenever I want. I've even been on some rides after it's closed for the day if they have a special occasion or are running maintenance. It's great when there are people in town. It's my party trick."
If you watch enough British mystery shows, and Stevie had, London will seem familiar, even to those who have never been near it in person. She had seen the London Eye in this way many times, spinning in the background of Sherlock. She understood it was a massive Ferris wheel, illuminated in violet, right on the water's edge. She let herself forget that she was not a fan of Ferris wheels, right up until the time that they were ushered quickly down a platform and into a pod that never stopped moving. Before she knew it, the compartment was sealed and Stevie and her friends were gliding up, 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 the Thames chugging below them, the Houses of Parliament and London in general shrinking below them. It was too dark to see details. Night brought out the contours, the lines made by artificial light. You could see the circulatory system of London, the roads, the bridges, the moving cars, everything pulsing with energy. The smaller buildings became a dark mass of shadow, and the larger ones presented their outlines. This was a city of jagged spires, ancient towers, and modern glass skyscrapers that jutted into the distant skyline like knives. One was literally called the Shard. The rain started falling in earnest, striking the pod, misting the glass, turning the view into streaks of light. As they rose, Izzy peppered them with questions about their trip. Had the flight been all right? How did they like their rooms? Were they tired? Were they having a good time? Oh, of course they had just gotten here. They wouldn't know if they were having a good time yet. She had long arms and graceful hands, which she swung about in wide, expressive gestures. She insisted on helping them take pictures. Group shots. David and Stevie. At least a dozen of Vi and Janelle making out against the London skyline. You may not be able to see the view much, but the two of you look adorable. She seemed to have a deep desire to be around the group, to help them in any way, which was weird. There was nothing off about the way Izzy and David chatted. It was all casual, references to school and the student house. But Stevie couldn't help but feel uneasy around this pleasant-smelling... She was wearing some kind of perfume that she identified as Jo Malone Orange Blossom when Janelle asked. Friendly, accommodating stranger.
Who the hell is she?
Nate asked Stevie quietly.
Why does she like us?
Stevie shrugged. We're likable?
Not really,
he said.
We're okay at best. Are all English people this friendly?
I don't know, Stevie said as Izzy encouraged Vi and Janelle into one more set of pictures. The wheel was dipping them back toward the water of the Thames, and the ride was coming to an end when Izzy came up alongside Stevie privately.
I'm so pleased you're here, she said. I've wanted to tell someone about this for so long, but I had no one to tell. Then David told me all about you, and I knew I had to tell you when you got here. I thought I'd wait until the ride was over. You see...
She gripped the rail that ran along the inside of the pod.
I have to tell you about a murder.
There it is,
Nate said, mostly under his breath. 7. Back on the ground, the rain drove them to seek shelter in the nearby South Bank complex, a gargantuan bunker of smooth gray concrete that Janelle assured them was in the brutalist style. Signage directed them to what seemed like dozens of spaces. Theaters, conference rooms, exhibitions, cafes. They took up residence at a table in one of the latter and huddled over some cups of tea and the last muffins of the day.
I know people must tell you that all the time, that they know about a murder, but it's true. My aunt saw a murder. She was there. It was her friends who were killed.
Izzy was talking fast, the words spilling from her mouth.
When my Aunt Angela was at Cambridge, she was in a theater group. This was a very close group. They all lived together in student housing. After exams their final year, they went off for a week's celebration. One of them, his name is Sebastian, he's lovely. His family owns a massive house in the country called Merriweather. They all went out there for a long party. On the first night, they were playing a game of hide-and-seek on the grounds. It started to rain, so they all came inside, except for two of them. A few of the group went looking for them the next morning. They found them in the woodshed. Dead, I mean. With an axe. They had disturbed some burglars during the night. That's what I always heard about it, but...
Izzy almost knocked over the remnants of her cup of tea as she leaned into the table.
Growing up, I heard the story. Never in depth. Just that Angela had been at a house party where some burglars came in during the night and killed two of her friends. She's very sensitive about it, obviously. I know there are places she avoids because of it. She prefers to be in the city. The countryside makes her quite nervous. I never thought any more of it until earlier this year. Over the summer, I was staying with Angela after she had an operation on her knee. She tore something at the gym and had to have it fixed, and she was immobilized for a week or two. She needed someone with her because she was taking painkillers and she couldn't get up for a few days, so I was there to make tea and bring her soup and things like that.
An adorable flap of the hand, indicating the many invalid-friendly foodstuffs Izzy had brought to her aunt's bedside.
She had the telly on, and there was a show on about a murder, and out of nowhere she said, "I think one of my friends murdered someone. I was there." So I said to her, "What do you mean?" And she said, "My friends, the ones who were killed, the lock was off the door. I saw the lock off the door." Then she kept saying something about things being planted. I could tell she wasn't hallucinating. She was saying something she really believed, but wouldn't have said out loud unless she was off her tits on pain medication.
"Your aunt said, 'I think one of my friends murdered someone,'" Stevie repeated.
"And also that she was there, and the lock and planted evidence or planting or something." Then I think she realized what she was saying and stopped. I had no idea what to do. I asked her about it later, and she tried to fob me off.
"Some pain medications are very strong," Janelle said. "Isn't it possible that she was just high? That she was saying things that had no bearing on reality?"
"If you had been there," Izzy said, "you would know. It was real. Her guard was down, but she was speaking with absolute clarity. She had a look in her eye like she was remembering something, like she just forgot who she was talking to about it. I've been thinking about this since it happened, and I can't let it go. I've read all I can about the murders, but there's not a lot. The point is, they never found out who did it. No one was ever accused or charged. It was written off as a robbery. But she knows something, and that something is eating her up inside. I didn't know what to do about any of this. And then I met David a few weeks ago, and he told me about you, and it seems like fate. I'm a great believer in fate. I've been waiting to meet you and tell you about it."
Now that Izzy had, in fact, told her about it, Stevie had no idea what to say next. Usually these things came in the form of messages, not people leaning over a cafe table with wide eyes, smelling faintly of orange blossom, tapping chipped green nails on the table surface, and picking at the remnants of a muffin.
"So, I had a thought." Izzy's thought floated on the air for a moment, swept up and around the table. "David mentioned you're doing a lot of tours, and that you're going to the Tower of London this week. Angela makes history shows for the BBC. She's an expert in all sorts of things about London history. She's making a new program now. I thought, if you wanted, we could get some takeaway and have dinner with her. She doesn't live far, just a few stops on the tube. I know she'd love to meet you, and she can tell you loads about Henry VIII and his wives. She knows everything about the tower. She's done something about it, an article or maybe part of a book. Because that's where they were beheaded, the wives, and maybe we could get her to talk about it. What do you say? There's an amazing restaurant down the road from her flat that does the best takeaway curry. Only if you want to, because I know you have plans, but I thought I'd offer since you're here and you're doing this sort of thing, and I suppose you'll have to eat dinner anyway, and—"
There was something almost elegant about the way Izzy rambled. Her conversation was a ball rolling on a marble floor, effortless in its unbroken motion, unstoppable without an outside force. Everything she said was polite and friendly, offered as a suggestion only. But the longer she spoke, the more Stevie realized that this was going to be the plan. It was too reasonable to fend off. You don't argue with a gentle breeze. Why wouldn't they go to meet with a historian, eat something delicious, and hear about an axe murder?
"Obviously, I don't want to change your plans."
Everyone looked at Janelle.
"Our dinners are generally open," she said. "And meeting with a historian who knows a lot about the Tower of London seems like a good thing to do."
"Oh, then perfect! We'll meet after you're done with your tours tomorrow. What time would work for you?"
Everyone looked a bit helpless in the face of this polite onslaught. Plus, the group was starting to fade a little from the lack of sleep and the time change and the cold rain. Stevie had the strong desire to go back to the student housing, get under a warm blanket, and take David with her. The matter was settled. They walked back to Craven House. Izzy's and David's lodgings were in one direction, and Stevie's and the others were in the opposite. Nate, Vi, and Janelle took the elevator first, leaving Izzy, Stevie, and David.
"Have a good night," Izzy said.
She paused, looking to David to walk in her direction, then shook her head and corrected herself.
"Oh, of course. You're going that way. See you tomorrow."
This was a very public way of acknowledging that David was going with Stevie. Though Stevie had gone off to private places with David many times, it still felt strange to her when someone else threw a spotlight on the fact. Like the world at large was conscious of her business. Which, of course, it was. As a detective, she observed other people. That other people observed her was the uncomfortable corollary. Once back in Stevie's room, David put his hands in his coat pockets and made a circuit of the small space. He knew this gesture pulled down on the coat, elongated it. He had a sly smile, a fox grin, as he looked around at the empty corkboard, her bags, the slightly crooked window blind. He stopped at the built-in desk on the wall and took a seat on the edge, then lifted the cheap plastic kettle there from its base.
"Even comes with a kettle," he said. "It's essential. They all love a kettle. Just fill it up and click."
He set it back on the base. "Did you know about all that?" Stevie said. "The murder stuff?" He nodded.
"She told me. She wanted to tell you. Everyone's got a story, huh?"
"I guess so."
"Well, now you get to meet a TV lady and hear about a murder. See the nice things I get for you?"
There was a pause.
"Come here,"
he said. Stevie was right by the light switch. She hesitated. Should she switch it off? That was a direct way of signaling what you expected to happen. It didn't seem smooth. But was it fun? She felt like she should err on the side of fun. She casually bumped it with her shoulder as she passed, as if she didn't mean to do it. He laughed. She walked across the half-lit room, trying not to stumble over the bags she had set on the floor. The street below provided much ambient glare, as the streetlight was just outside. It was enough light to see the contours of his face, his long nose, the little quirked peaks of his eyebrows.
"I'm really,"
he said, leaning in,
"really, really glad you came."
She pressed herself up to kiss him, hard. She felt a tremor through her whole body, a warmth, a sense that the entire world was here, running between them. This position, leaning halfway against the desk, was impossible to maintain. They both sank to the floor, ignoring the bed. The cold linoleum was the best surface in the world. His hands slipped under her t-shirt. She tried to shrug it off, but the hoodie got in the way. She sat up to remove the hoodie, remove the t-shirt. This would have been the moment to deploy the fancy bra that Janelle had shown her. But then, what did it matter? The stretched-out sports bra was just as good, and David was reaching for the phone. It was ringing, that is. A video call from Dr. Quinn. "Shit," Stevie said, reaching for her shirt. "Shit, shit, shit, I was supposed to call. Shit." She pulled her shirt on and stood up, her head still spinning and her legs a little weak. She ran a quick hand through her hair, which did nothing. David Crab crawled away a few paces as Stevie answered. "Oh," Stevie said. "Hi, I'm sorry. I got confused about the time. I was unpacking."
"In the dark?"
Dr. Quinn said. She was leaning back in her chair in her office at Ellingham, making the call from her computer. Stevie got the full effect of looking across the desk.
"I just came in. I was in Janelle's room. Sorry."
She reached over and turned on the little reading light next to the bed. The effect was like pointing a flashlight at her face, like she was trying to tell a scary story. She sat down on the bed and tried to seem casual.
"How's the accommodation?"
"Fine," Stevie said.
"Nice, good, fine."
"Fine and nice and good. Let's see it."
On hearing this, David began to move around the room, away from the focus of the camera.
"Switch on the main light so I can see," Dr. Quinn said.
"Yeah," Stevie kept David out of frame as she crossed over to the light switch by the door. She illuminated the room and continued panning around. The room was so small that David had to squeeze behind her and step up on the bed to keep out of sight. It let out a small, plasticky creak.
Oh, hello, David, Dr. Quinn said. Come over and wave to me.
Stevie opened her mouth in a pathetic attempt at denial. But before she could embarrass herself, Dr. Quinn shook her head. David pulled on his shirt and adjusted it, then stepped in front of the camera.
Hi,
he said.
It's been a while. I was just showing Stevie how the kettle works.
He pressed down the lever on the kettle and it lit up and gurgled happily, as if it were delighted by the prospect of a nice cup of tea.
It's a complicated machine, Dr. Quinn said. Took me a while to master it. Leave Stevie's room now. I'll be on the phone with her for a while, so there's no point in waiting outside. Yep,
David said.
Yep. Anyway, Stevie, that's how the kettle works, so see you tomorrow.
She knew. Of course she knew. It could have been an educated guess, or maybe she had someone on the inside, or maybe she had tapped into the CCTV mainframe. She was Dr. Jenny Quinn, so anything was possible.
I think it would be best, she said, if David kept out of your room. It's late there, and you must be exhausted from your trip. Jet lag hits fast, though I find it's often worse on the second day. Get some rest. Enjoy your kettle.
From the notebook of DCI Philip Starling, Gloucester Constabulary, 24 June, 1995. Background. Incident took place at Merriweather, a large house on over 50 acres, with numerous outbuildings and extensive grounds. The owners are currently in Greece, and it was known locally that the house might be unoccupied. Son of owner, who attends Cambridge, returned to the house with 8 friends for a visit, arriving approximately 10 p.m. last night. No staff was present on this evening, and all have been accounted for. Interviews of 7 witnesses, housemates, paint a consistent story of a house party with a game of team hide-and-seek being played on the grounds between 11 p.m. and 2:30 a.m. During this time, all members of the house party were freely running the grounds and were both hiding and seeking. Witness statements contain details. There was a powerful electrical storm going on while the game took place. At approximately 2:30 a.m., the storm took down power lines at the opening of St. Swithin's Lane, which is the only road that leads in or out of Merriweather. Merriweather and the village of Ramscote-on-Wyle lost electricity, and emergency services dispatched a van to deal with the downed wire and prevent fire or accidental electrocutions. This van arrived at 3 a.m. and remained in place until 7:30 a.m. To prevent vehicles or people from going near the wire, they stationed the van across the opening of St. Swithin's Lane, blocking entry or exit. During this time, no vehicles could have come in or out of Merriweather without encountering the van. The workers reported that no vehicles or persons came down the road, which was not surprising, given the hour and the severity of the storm. Note, Merriweather has an electric gate which is accessed by a numerical keypad. The code is known to many locals who work at or make deliveries to the property. With the power down, the gate would have to be forced open, and there were no signs of forced entry at the gate. The 7 witnesses returned to the house when the power went out. 2 members of the party, Rosalind Mortimer and Noel Butler, did not respond to calls that announced the end of the game. The witnesses said that there was a romance budding between the two, and it was assumed they had gone somewhere in private and did not wish to be disturbed. The remaining 7 stayed in the house the rest of the night, drinking and talking. None reported hearing anything out of the ordinary, but the storm would have easily drowned out any cries for help or noises of intruders. Witness Susanna Rillington states that she clearly saw the beam of a torch at the front of the house. She could not provide an exact time, but given the fact that the sun had not yet risen, she estimated this would have been around 3 to 3:30 a.m. Around noon today, witnesses Theodora Bailey and Sebastian Holt Carey went looking for the lost members of the group. In their search, they found an upturned wheelbarrow in front of a woodshed located near the garage. The woodshed is used for wood and garden implement storage and contains nothing of value. The door of the woodshed had been forced open, tearing the latch from the wood. The shed is locked with a padlock, which was found intact. Assuming that someone had attempted to burgle the shed, the witnesses entered to inspect the damage. Inside, they found the bodies of Mortimer and Butler. Impressions of victims and scene. Both victims were found partially covered in firewood, and both had been attacked with a sharp, heavy weapon that left wedge-shaped injuries consistent with an axe. The axe normally kept in the woodshed was missing. A long-handled axe was found by P.C. Whitscale in a small stream running through the property. Both victims had multiple injuries and massive blood loss. The location of the wheelbarrow and the use of the axe indicates disturbance of a crime in progress. The door of the shed was open, and rainwater had pooled on the floor, eliminating any potential footprints and washing away blood and other debris. Light for the shed was provided by a single light bulb fixed to the ceiling. This had been smashed, and faint traces of blood were found on the edges, suggesting that it was broken by the axe during the attack. Bits of broken bulb were found on top of the wood that covered Mortimer, but under Butler's body. This seems to indicate that Mortimer died first. Butler likely entered the scene after Mortimer was already dead and under the logs. Medical examiner arrived on the scene at 2 p.m. Initial impression is that both Mortimer and Butler died around the same time. This time could not be determined with any exactitude. However, the pair had been dead somewhere between 10 and 12 hours. As they were last seen at 11 p.m., this places the window at between 11 p.m. and 4 a.m., covering all the hours of darkness. Several of the witnesses state that they passed the woodshed during the course of the game and found it intact, with no wheelbarrow in front. There were two keys to this shed, one with the gardener, who was at home, and one on the key ring of Holt Carey, who had it in his possession at all times. It was established for the game that outbuildings were locked and off-limits. Unless the intruder or intruders came on foot, which is unlikely considering the location of Merryweather and the size and weight of potential stolen goods. This suggests the intruder or intruders arrived and left the scene prior to the loss of power at 2:30 a.m. Vehicle was likely parked out of view of the house.
Note time discrepancy of statement of witness Rillington regarding torchlight.
If intruders left at 2:30, there would be no torchlight at 3 or later. Likely explanation in that witness had been consuming alcohol all evening and there was a good deal of lightning in the night. Timeline of power services much more reliable. Addendum, 12 July. Blood found on remains of light bulbs still in the ceiling has been matched to Mortimer. 8.
A panopticon, Vi said. They were sitting around a tall, slightly wobbly table at the corner prêt-à-manger, having breakfast. Stevie had opted for a large coffee and a brownie, which was maybe not the best choice, but it felt right. She was a little confused about what time it was, and therefore she would need to be powered by all the sugar and caffeine she could pump into her system. It's a concept of a prison, Vi went on, picking out the chunks of mango in their fruit cup to eat them first. It's circular. The people in the prison are arranged around a central guard station that you can't see into. The idea is that you only need one guard, because the imprisoned persons never know when they are being watched, so they have the feeling of always being watched. Vi was a student of prison reform, and this was the kind of thing they knew off the top of their head. Quinn doesn't have to be everywhere, Vi went on. She just has to be somewhere.
Do you think she's really got someone in the building who's watching us, or did she get lucky? Stevie asked.
Doesn't matter, Vi said. That's the point.
Why does she even care? Stevie said.
When you're a guardian, you have to make sure sex isn't happening, even when you know it is and there's nothing wrong with it. It's patriarchal hangover. Not even a hangover. Just patriarchal.
Their face took on a disappointed cast as they had eaten all the mango, the single strawberry, and the three grapes, and now reached the milky pale melon pieces that lurk at the base of every cup of fruit. Vi was not a waster of food. so they grimly set about consuming the tasteless melon. Throughout this discussion, Janelle had been consulting the schedule on her phone and nodding at various points to show her agreement. She was looking spectacular for their big day out in London. Janelle had recently gotten into online consignment shopping and had picked up some clothes she referred to as pieces. She was wearing one now, a form-fitting sweater dress with zigzagging rows of multicolored autumnal shades. "This is vintage Missoni. I got it for 55 bucks because I had a little hole in the hem. I can fix that no problem. Missoni!" Her hair was up in two bunches, which she had accented with multiple bronze and orange barrettes. Janelle was not playing around on a trip like this. "We should walk back the way we went last night," she said, "along the river, and catch the hop-on-hop-off bus at Temple Pier, which is really close. So we should finish and go. Nate, are you going to get anything to eat?"
"Not hungry," he said. "We should get going."
The plan, which had seemed so sensible and short and compact when Stevie had first seen it, was now in motion. They bought passes for the hop-on-and-off tour bus and rode around London, Janelle tracking on her phone. They got off to see the changing of the guard at Buckingham Palace, which involved standing at a gate while people in huge black fur hats moved around. Back on the bus to the far corner of Hyde Park. Hyde Park was exactly what the name suggested. A park, and a lot of it. It connected to Moor Park. Travel has so much between time. Walking around and trying to figure out where you were. There was Kensington Palace, the Peter Pan statue, the Serpentine, where they considered getting a boat but there was no time, Speaker's Corner. Then through an arch to Moor Park, a different park. This one was Green Park, which was basically Buckingham Palace's back garden. This led to St. James's Park and St. James's Palace. There were way more palaces than Stevie thought. Down to Westminster, to 10 Downing Street and the Imperial War Rooms. Back on the bus, back in some other direction. Where were they? Covent Garden? Soho? Russell Square, just names now, names and massive buildings. Her head was spinning and her attention flagging. Izzy. She appeared in Stevie's mind. The point of her chin, her long hands, her fuzzy coat. Her masses of hair that looked adorably perfect piled on her head like a glamorous owl sanctuary. Izzy and David spent so much time together here. He hadn't mentioned her on their calls. Or had he? Maybe once he mentioned an is. Stevie probably thought he said is or something. Why not mention her? He planned things with her, like that ride last night. Of course, it was a good surprise. He got her a trip on the London Eye and a murder story. And yet, so much time together. So many London nights like the one last night. So many long evenings and drizzling rain and talking at the pub and walking these streets, the streets she didn't know. "My aunt saw a murder. She was there." She looked down at her phone and did some searching. She had only a few points of reference for her search. Two murders, 1995, a country house, a burglar. Google didn't turn up much. She only found one or two articles, and they all repeated the basic facts that Izzy had told her. Nine students, recently graduated from Cambridge, went to a house called Merriweather on June 23, 1995. That night, during a storm, they played an outdoor game of hide-and-seek. Two members of the party never came back inside and were discovered in the morning in the woodshed, murdered with an axe. The matter was thought to be connected to several local burglaries. And that was it. Nothing more. The two cases she had worked on before, the Ellingham case and the Box in the Woods murders, both had substantial coverage. The lack of information out in the world was both disappointing and intriguing. This was fresh ground. Undisturbed.
"We're here,"
Nate said, tapping her on the arm. They had returned to their starting point. Stevie hadn't even noticed. She hurriedly grabbed her bag and followed Nate down the steps to the lower level and off the bus. Janelle and Vi had already disembarked. The dark was gathering over Craven House as they stepped into the greenish light of the lobby. The tree looked slightly sadder today.
It was leaning to the left, and someone had put googly eyes on a few of the ornaments. Two balls had fallen off the tree and were lolling underneath.
"Harsh,"
Nate said, noting it as he passed.
"You know, the best fanfic I ever read was an erotic story about Thor and Tony Stark living together on a Christmas tree sex farm."
"What?" Vi said. "Was it a sex farm or a Christmas tree farm?"
"Both,"
Nate replied as they pushed open the doors into the common room.
"Mostly sex, some tree. I don't think they were taking the business seriously because that was no way to handle a wreath."
The common room was a large space with a shocking purple carpet, several wood-framed sofas and large work tables, with a small bar in the corner that didn't appear to be open. David and Izzy were already there, sitting together on a sofa working on their individual laptops. Izzy was wearing an oversized white blouse with large sleeves. On Stevie, it would have been a confused mess, and it sort of was on Izzy as well, but it was also charming. Something funny hit Stevie. A little sizzle of something unpleasant. "Oh," Izzy cried, getting up. "You're back. Ready to go?" Izzy's aunt lived in a place called Islington, which was several tube stops to the north on something called the Northern Line, a black line on the orderly squiggles of the tube map. This meant they had to walk to the embankment stop, which was down along the path they had taken before, by the river. The tube. The famous tube. It was nothing to David now. He'd been here for months and tapped his card lightly on the reader, while Stevie and the others fumbled with their tickets. He and Izzy chatted and joked as they rode down the incredibly long escalator into the depths below London. The walls were paneled in screens that repeated the same rotation of advertisements as they went down, trying desperately to get her to buy a new thriller called Blood at Dawn. Attend a production of Richard III, and buy dessert for Christmas at a place called M&S. There was a light, minerally smell, somewhere between fuel and the sweet, unused smell that basements sometimes had. Another little sizzle as Izzy showed David something on her phone.
"There was nothing to be jealous about," was what she told herself as they stood on the platform, looking across at the massive advertisements that were plastered along the curved walls of the tube.
If anything, Izzy seemed more excited about Stevie. But what if that was what you did when you were trying to hide something?
"Hey."
David was whispering against her ear. The feeling of his warm breath made her tingle, and the entire right side of her body seemed to go into a liquid state.
"Guess what?"
he whispered.
"What?" "Chicken butt."
He flicked her ear with his tongue. There was a rush of wind and the train appeared. There was a polite bong sound. And then the recorded voice said, "Mind the gap," in a staid English accent.
"It really does that?"
Nate said. The train was utterly rammed with people. There were no seats to be had and very little standing room. They all crushed together in a forest of arms, wobbling as the train sped along. Janelle and Vi squished together by a pole. David had looped an arm around Stevie. It was warm on the train, and the gentle rocking motion made Stevie start to drift off. She wasn't asleep, but she wasn't as awake as she wanted to be. There was no time to sleep on this trip. This was all she had. Every day was valuable. Every night. There was a lot of squeezing and standing and wobbling and pressing before the train expelled them at a place called Angel. They emerged on a wide street of shops and restaurants.
"It's not far," Izzy said brightly. "About a 15-minute walk."
This was not quite the around-the-corner-sounding place that Izzy had indicated. Finally, after walking down at least a dozen streets, they stopped at a restaurant on the corner called the Rose of Bengal that played old Bollywood movies on a large screen.
"I'll get a selection of dishes to share, if that's all right," Izzy said. "My treat. Are there vegetarians?"
Vi had been transitioning to a vegan diet, so this was noted. Izzy ordered an array of things that Stevie didn't know. All the dishes going to the tables in little copper pots looked and smelled incredible, but she didn't know what they were. It sounded like they were having all of it. Lamb bunna, rogan josh,
tandoori prawns, saag paneer, alu gobi, bindi masala, chana masala, chapati, paratha, peshwari naan. A few of these words sounded vaguely familiar, but she was lost. For the first time since arriving here, she felt the depth of distance. She couldn't even figure out what David's new friend was getting them for dinner. After a short wait, they were presented with three brimming bags and headed back out, following Izzy down a street filled with rows of identical two-story brown brick terraced houses. Each had six concrete or stone steps leading up to a shiny black door, and a low fence of black wrought iron along the sidewalk, separating off a recessed area where there was a lower level. Stevie didn't really know what things were like in Dickens's time, but she imagined the building much like this, with chimney sweeps and cooks and maids talking to one another on the stoops. Now, instead of horses, there were impossibly small cars and scooters lining the road, and plastic trash bins stationed aside the stoop. "Hello, doorknob," Izzy said.
"Did you just say hello to the doorknob?" David asked.
Izzy pointed to the top of a recycling bin next to them in the tiny forecourt of the house. Sitting on top, like the Cheshire Cat from Alice in Wonderland, was a large orange cat, slapping at his own tail. "This is Doorknob," she said, passing David the food bags and scooping the cat into her arms. "Because, dumb as a. His favorite toy is the wall. He has a cat flap, but he can't work out how it works. You're not bright at all, are you? But you're a good boy. She's going to be so excited." Stevie wasn't sure if she meant the cat, but the cat seemed to be male.
"She?"
Stevie asked.
"Your aunt, she knows we're coming, right?"
"I texted her," Izzy replied. Izzy knocked twice, then produced a set of keys and opened the door a crack to lead them into a darkened vestibule, which was tidily full of coats on a row of pegs, a bike, and a stone statue of a Buddha on the floor. She set Doorknob down, and he circled three times before strolling through an open doorway into what looked like the living room. There was a light on somewhere above them, but no sound.
"Hello," Izzy called up the stairs. "Just me. I brought food."
Which seemed like an odd thing to say, since it was not just Izzy, and suggested that food had not been previously discussed. Stevie heard a chair roll back and footsteps. A woman came down the steps. She bore enough of a resemblance to Izzy to confirm that this was, in fact, her aunt. Her hair was cropped to her chin and full of bouncy curls. She had well-manicured eyebrows, professionally full, but wore no makeup. She was dressed in pajama bottoms and an oversized t-shirt.
"Oh," she said. "Hello."
"I brought some friends," Izzy said. "This is David from uni, and these are some of his friends from America. This is Janelle and Vi and Nate, and this is Stevie. Stevie Bell."
She said it in a way that suggested that Angela should know the name and maybe clap. She did not.
"Oh," Angela said. "Right. Nice to meet you."
She looked at Izzy with an expression that said, "Why have you brought me five Americans? I did not order five Americans."
"They're doing a tour of historical sites," Izzy went on. "They're going to the tower tomorrow, and I thought, since I know you never eat when you're working, I'd bring food and maybe we could chat."
So Izzy hadn't told her aunt that this was happening. They were crashing. They were crashing with a lot of food, but they were crashing. Stevie looked to David in concern, but he just shrugged and gave a half smile.
"Oh, right. Of course, yes. And you're well-timed. I haven't eaten today, and I'm starving.
Izzy knows me. Yes, let's go through to the kitchen." Angela recovered from her initial surprise, or at least made a good effort at covering. The kitchen was at the back of the house, a small, cheerful space with pale yellow walls. Izzy dumped the bags on the table, and Angela started pulling down plates from the cabinet, while the five Americans shifted around and tried not to get in the way, which was difficult.
"Are you over on holiday?" Angela asked politely.
"We're on a week-long study abroad trip," Janelle offered.
"Oh, right. That's quite fun."
Izzy kept pulling containers from the bag. It seemed endless. There were little tin dishes of steaming rice with yellow and orange flecks in it, multiple curries, dishes of chickpeas and greens, flatbreads, and then about a dozen tiny plastic cups of condiments, none of which Stevie could recognize. This was one of those moments where she felt like she had failed at some primary task of life, to know the basics of an Indian takeout meal. Angela sneezed loudly several times.
"I'm getting over a cold," she said by way of an apology for dabbing at her nose with the napkin. "I can just about taste. How much was the food?"
Angela examined the receipt.
£78. "Here."
She went into a drawer and produced 4 20-pound notes and handed them to Izzy.
"Oh, no," Izzy said. "Really?"
Angela gave her an "I'm your aunt and you are taking this money" wave, and Izzy accepted the notes. They all filled their plates with the food, which looked as beautiful as it smelled delicious. The rich red and soft yellow of the curries, the charred bubbles on the fresh bread, the bright pops of cilantro. Nate eagerly filled his plate until it almost ran over the edge. There wasn't enough room in the kitchen for 7 people, so they decamped to the living room, where Angela tried to make her unexpected guests comfortable.
"So, Stevie and Janelle and Nate and Vi all go to a school called Ellingham Academy in Vermont," Izzy said,
sitting on the floor alongside the coffee table and tucking into her meal.
"And David went there as well.